What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. A great guest today. He is, by his own telling, the best free agent point guard on the market this summer. He's also one of the most thoughtful and interesting players in the league. He is Spencer Dinwiddie, currently of the Brooklyn Nets. I say currently because, as we know, Spencer is a free agent this summer, and he's going to be in high demand. And to his point, I think he is the best free agent point guard available, because the best free agent point guard will be Chris Paul, who I think is going to stay in Phoenix and thus unavailable. Spencer was really candid about what he's looking for in free agency and about the Nets' chances of keeping him. We also discussed his quick rehab from ACL surgery, his recent cryptic posts on Instagram, he explains them, and his new business endeavor. It's a social media platform called Galaxy, that's like Galaxy with a C. Really interesting stuff and just a great conversation all the way through. Before we get to that, a reminder, please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about us. And if you've got feedback, you can always hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck. You can also find Spencer Dinwiddie there at SDinwiddie_25. Okay, my chat with Spencer Dinwiddie is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, pleased to be joined by the NBA's foremost expert on cryptocurrency, NFTs, and other things that I don't understand and kind of make my head hurt. Spencer Dinwiddie. Spencer, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Nice to be sitting down with you.
You too. We will get to all of those big words that I just said that I don't understand in a little bit here, because I know that's a big area of interest off the court for you. But before we get to that, of course, I have to start with the health check-in, because it's just mandatory. And you had something on Instagram the other day, which looked kind of promising. You were midair, pretty close to the rim, saying, quote, "Well, looks like the best free agent point guard is ready." So how ready is ready?
Ready is ready. If I was on the Suns or the Bucks, I'd be playing basketball right now. So, you know, I'm excited. And yes, I did dunk that basketball. I'm just happy. And by that comment, I'm more so, I know Chris Paul's still playing. I know he has a chance to opt out. So it had much less to kind of do with him or anything. I know a lot of people had comments on that. But just kind of more speaking to my age group, my demographic, the Shoulders, the Lonzos, all those people that people are kind of comparing me to. Like, at the end of the day, this is no shot or no shade, but I'm the only one to lead a team to the playoffs. And so I believe if we're measuring people based on winning it, and obviously my stats as well, like it's not even really that close. Like the other guys are great players and they've been a part of playoff teams, but they never had to be the guy that led a team to the playoffs. So, you know, the greatest marker of a point guard is to win. And I believe I've done that at a higher level than them.
No question. Now, obviously, yeah. I mean, it's social media. The second you say anything, people are immediately going to look for like, who's he throwing shade at? Like, come on, folks. Like, we all know Chris Paul's not leaving Phoenix. Okay.
Exactly.
Spencer Dinwiddie clearly was not declaring himself greater than Chris Paul. Like, that's just people trying to start trouble.
Exactly.
But you did say if you were on the Suns or Bucks, you'd be playing right now. The New York Daily News had a story a few weeks ago saying, and this is while the Nets were still in it, that if the Nets made the finals, you were planning to play. So that sounds accurate.
Yeah, no, it was. And obviously no official timeline at that point in time was released, because I was trying to hit like the last couple markers and had to check the last couple boxes. And, you know, obviously if I came out and said that definitively and then I was delayed by 2 weeks and missed the finals, and everybody would say like, oh no, like what happened? But, you know, I've been very pleased. I mean, I recovered from ACL in 5.5 months. Like, you know, it's been a crazy ride, a crazy journey, and I'd have been able to play, and it would have been a blast to be able to be out there.
That's an amazing turnaround. And I mean, you know, you've been through ACL before in college. It was your other knee, I believe.
Yeah.
But that was a full tear, I think, and this one was only a partial. So you've got more perspective on this than most. Was this a lot I want to say easier because like it's a bitch regardless, but speaking, easier.
Relatively speaking, I mean, look, people don't understand. Like when I was in college and I tore my left knee, I tore my lateral meniscus, my medial meniscus, my ACL completely, and my MCL. So it was terrible, like bad, and like bad. You know what I'm saying? Like so much so, you know, they said I wouldn't come back and play for a full year. That, you know, it'd probably take me at least 18 months to return to form if I was able to like get back to that high, high level. So there was a lot of question marks involved around that. You know what I mean? And I came back from that one, I believe 7.5 months or so. Right. So crushed that timeline too, obviously much longer than this one. But this situation was a partial tear of my right ACL, no other structural damage, MCL fine, meniscus, all that other stuff. Right. So when people thought that I was speaking with bravado or just talking, quite frankly, out of my behind about, you know, coming back this season or things of that nature, they didn't understand that I had true perspective, you know, and that's all I was speaking from was experience. It wasn't bravado. It wasn't, you know, bragging. It wasn't anything like that. But I really genuinely felt if I could take a basically, you know, full knee reconstruction almost, right, and then come back in 7.5 months, granted, I was, you know, only 20 years old at the time. So I was younger, but I didn't have NBA rehab. I didn't have NBA resources. And then I didn't have the Nets training staff behind me, you know, and all that stuff. Like, why would I think that I can't take a partial tear and try to make history and come back and be with the guys and all that other stuff? Like, I believe in Riley as a surgeon. I believe in the Nets training staff as a whole, and then being able to guide and help me pick specialists to work out with while in LA. And the whole reason I came to LA is because it allowed me to have 12-hour rehab days, you know what I'm saying, Monday through Friday, and then still put in some extra work on Saturdays. And obviously Sundays were off, but, you know, that's the type of work that I was putting in. And when you're traveling with the team, you know, flying up and down and all that stuff, especially in the first part of rehab, like it's tougher to have the focus, because at the end of the day, like, you know, the training staff that's on the ground in Brooklyn has to focus on the people that are playing. So Chris Choza, who's not necessarily playing that much, but if he has an ankle sprain, it's going to be a higher priority than Spencer Dinwiddie, who may come back, you know, in 5 months. And that's not a bad thing. That's how it should be. You know what I mean? Like, you should service the players that are playing. But if I can come out here and put together 12-hour rehab days with no plane rides and, you know, nothing that's going to be, you know, cause more swelling or, you know, be adversely, you know, conducive to the goal, then, you know, the Nets allowing me to do that also under their supervision was obviously what was best for not just me, but also for the team. And it allowed us to collectively make history, because this isn't something that you do by yourself. It's not like I laid in the bed for 5.5 months and just healed. You know, like, I had the Nets training staff watching over me, Riley as a surgeon, Barron's the soft tissue for Brees, Mike G, Craig Sanchez. Like, there's just so many people that played a part in this and made it possible.
That's amazing. It's unfortunate we didn't get to see you actually complete that incredible recovery by actually playing at the end of it, right? Like, yeah, the next time we see you on a court is, and who knows whose jersey that will be or what city, but that's going to be in October probably, right? Unless you're going to make a cameo appearance at Summer League in Vegas, which I'm guessing probably not.
No.
This Nets season, you know, for you, I mean, because you rehabbed the way you did, which obviously was the right choice, but then you're separated from the team at a time that this team was, I mean, rapidly changing, right? Durant finally suits up in December, Kyrie's back fully healthy, and then they make the trade for James Harden. What was it like for you to be kind of like, you're part of this, but you're at a distance, you're not playing, you're rehabbing, the team has changed dramatically, yeah, around you. You and Joe Harris, I think, like the only holdovers from that intermediary period, the Kenny Atkinson teams that were just kind of getting you guys back on the map. So what was it like to just kind of be kind of cut off that way at a time when the Nets were obviously, you know, pushing for a championship?
It was weird. You know, I mean, it was kind of just the circumstances. I mean, the thing that both weird and not, right? Because, like, I'm still close to Joe Harris. I'm close to DeAndre Jordan. Like, I'm close to Jeff Green. So there are people that I talk to on a semi-consistent basis that are still on the team and all that stuff. So you feel a part of it. And obviously, I don't know James well, but, like, you know, that's one guy. So it's like you know, and now he's a huge part of it. So huge part of it. So it's like, oh, like, I don't know James, but I'm really close to Joe. You know what I'm saying? I don't know this guy, but I'm talking to Nick every other day. You know what I mean? So it's just kind of, it's a fluid situation. And, you know, it's interesting. And if I go back to the Nets, obviously, you know, I'll still have basically family there. Like, you know, like it's where I've spent the last several years of my career, and I've loved every moment of it. So, you know, it's not something that is bad. I think it was a little bit more overblown in terms of the disconnectedness just because of the type of injury. If this was like a 2-week injury, 3-week injury, and I just took the random sabbatical, then like that'd be kind of weird. You know what I mean? But like, this is something that we knew if I did come back, it was going to be at the very end. Right. So we wanted to get as much rehab as we possibly could, come back, possibly get like a, you know, a week or 2 week kind of integration period in there where like we could really kind of blend back in, you know what I'm saying, with the guys, with the team, play your 3-on-3, 5-on-5s, had a little ramp up and then be good to go, you know, when money time was. So
this may be an obvious answer, but any doubt in your mind that if you guys stay healthy, you know, especially James and Kyrie, but even if you'd been healthy and available, you know, in the second round, are the Nets playing in the finals right now?
Oh, of course. I mean, and once again, like you said, without me, like they're a championship team, regardless. Obviously, they're one of the most talented rosters ever assembled. And yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. I don't know him, and this is now with me healthy. I don't know a more talented roster like in history. You know, like especially that, and take away LaMarcus retiring, then I really don't know a more talented roster in history. Like it's absolutely insane the group of guys that we've been able to assemble, and then also with everybody being under 35. You know what I mean? Like I feel like, you know, if guys are like 38, 39, then they kind of be like, oh, okay, whatever. But like under 35, you still got a ton of, like, you got some really good basketball models. Like you may only play 15, 20 minutes a game instead of 35, but like you got a ton of good basketball models. I think Blake proved that. And just looking at the roster as a whole, like it's insane.
No, the firepower is ridiculous if they could just keep all three guys on the court at the same time. But it was that kind of season. It was a weird season, you know, not just for the Nets, but for everybody. A lot of stuff happened. But I want to take a step back for a second here. Because I've talked to Nets fans that I know about this too. I'm curious, like you were part of this team, Spencer, that, you know, as we know, like the Nets were in a hole, no draft picks, everything is. And so Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson come in, you're part of this group, you, Joe Harris, Caris LeVert, Jared Allen, all these guys, and you guys got to be known for a certain amount of just grit and character. A team that was overachieving, which is not like, that's a compliment, not an insult. It is because you were, all of you were either sold short or drafted low, or you and Joe Harris had been, you know, cast aside by a couple of teams, all that. And so there was a charm to that team for fans and for people like me in the media. Like, this is fun to see this team just gritting it out and surprising everybody. You build up to a certain point and then boom, Kenny's gone. Boom. Other guys are gone to make room for Kyrie and KD. And then boom, the trade for Hart. Like the only guys left, as I said, I think are you and Joe Harris, to the best you can. Cause the goal is the championship. And if you're part of this team next season, like you're just going to, I'm sure, be thrilled to be part of a team with these three Hall of Famers and contending for a championship. I get that. Yeah. But the charm and the different vibe about a team that just kind of built its own rep, that willed itself into existence almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give me your sense of like what it's like to be part of those two things and straddling those two things.
I mean, everybody wants to win. So it's more fun winning. I think the charm and the grit and where we were as a team in terms of just kind of the collective, like pluckiness, I guess, was cool to be a part of. We had an interesting group of personalities, which was, you know, fun to be a part of. And I think kind of being the media darling is cool, in that sense. But that's also because I feel like we relate more to people when, you know, you have to scratch and claw and fight and things like that, right? Like when you're blowing people out, everybody looks at you almost like the government. You start to kind of resent the power, right? Yeah. I would say it's more fun being the villain. Why? Because, like, let's go win. And if people don't like you, they don't like you. But they can't, you know what I'm saying, take the win away. You know, so I guess it's tough, man. Being on both sides, it's tough. There's pros and cons to both, but I'll take the wins.
That's what I figured. I figured. You know, I'm a media guy. We like the story, right? And so, and yes, there is something about the super teams that, you know, everybody I think wrestles with as to whether like they're fun to watch, but at the same time, you always feel like, it's a little bit of a cheat code. And so it's harder to embrace. So, all right, real quick on free agency. And back to your Instagram, because you've been active on the gram. Two lyrics that you posted recently that people were reading quite a bit into. One was, "Please don't speak to me like I'm that man from 4 years ago. I'm at a higher place." And the other one was, "No one could be my op." That shit offends me.
Yeah. So a lot of my captions, especially if I put quotes on them, they're actually lyrics.
Yes.
So Drake has a line, and I believe it's "No Telling." He says, "Please do not speak to me like I'm that Drake from 4 years ago. I'm at a higher place." Right. So all that meant was literally like, hey, you know, all that stuff from, you know, the past or whatever, we're talking about the old injury or we're talking about other stuff. Like I'm a different person. Like I've earned my stripes. Like these things, like sometimes when people, you know, comment on me, they're like, "Oh, like you average 4 points a game in Detroit. Like, why are you talking crazy?" I averaged 21 points a game last season. What do you mean? I'm not the guy in Detroit that didn't play. I'm the guy that averaged 21. You know what I'm saying? Literally last season and took a team to the playoffs. So don't conflate the two as if like you can take a diss from 7 years ago and come and use it, you know what I'm saying, against me right now or anything like that. It's just the complete perspective. And not only that, I'm older. Like I'm 28 years old. I have a son. Like you just change. Like it's like life, you continuously grow. So like deal with the person that is standing in front of you right now and his views and stuff like that.
So this was more of a clap back at some people as opposed to this being a, kind of like a posturing about your free agency or your value or your contract hopes or anything like that.
Yeah. It's more so like a life philosophy. Most of the things that I say, it's not, think about it, right? The Nets are very much on the table. I could go back to the Nets. I don't know if I will, right? Like I'm a free agent, but like, that's not something that I wrote off. If it was something that I wasn't going to do, I would literally tell you like, "Hey, I'm not going back to the Nets. There's nothing that they could do. There's no amount of money that they could pay me. I will not go," like blah, blah. But that's not the case. So why would I, you know, posture against them or something like that if like this is not the case?
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not here to make enemies. I'm literally just talking about more like a life philosophy, like deal with 28-year-old Spencer that's standing in front of you right now. That's it. And the other lyric, that's a Nicki Minaj lyric. That one more so has to do with just kind of like thinking about like my business, where I'm at, all the other stuff, right? Like sometimes people think like it's so like singular, right? Like oh, this one thing or one person or whatever stands in my way or something like that. Like, you know, what she says in that line and into further, she says, "No one man can be my ops or my opposition that offends me. It's corporate giants and machines that went against me," right? So it basically what she's saying is like it's a whole business. It's a whole, you know, system and things that I'm trying to break into and change. And if you look at Calix and what I'm trying to do, like I'm trying to create a next generation social media platform. Like the likelihood that I'm worried about one singular person standing in front of me or, you know, whatever it is, it's probably very low. Like the battles and things that, you know, I've had to fight in certain respects are just kind of different. And so, you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, focused on the wrong things in a sense.
No, that makes sense. Thank you for clarifying both of those. So last thing on free agency, because this is interesting. So the Nets have your bird rights. Obviously they can pay you your full value, whatever you and they determine that to be. They can do that. They certainly have the means to pay the luxury tax to the nth degree if necessary, which it probably would be if they're bringing you back. But this is an interesting situation where you'd be coming back to a team that has Kyrie Irving, a primary ball handler scorer type, James Harden's ball handler scorer type. You know, you've got an opportunity for the first time since you became this Spencer Dinwiddie, to your point, right? You're a different guy today than when you arrived in Brooklyn in 2016 when the Nets signed you. And you've earned the right to be a starter with the full responsibility that goes with that somewhere else. You could go lead a team. To the extent that you're comfortable with it right now, you want to tip your free agency negotiating hand. I get that. But how do you weigh, the money could be the same in all places, but when does the role and getting to have the responsibility and more about a team that you kind of run come into play, and how much does that weigh in now?
Money all being the same, it's kind of hard to say, because remember, the Nets can do something that's powerful, right? They have the fifth year. So let's say market value is 25 million, right, for a starting point guard. That means I can get 375 or 400 from other places, right? I can get 5125 from the Nets. You feel me? And then you got to weigh out what's likely a 375 from other places or a 5125 from the Nets. And then you say, okay, here I'm going to start. Maybe I don't start at the 5125 with the Nets, but like I get to be a part of what we were building, likely championship, all the other things. So that's an interesting, dynamic. And so we have to see what happens. But if the Nets put 5125 on the table, it's not something I'm just going to be like, oh, I'm out. I don't care. I don't love you guys, anything like that. So, it's for all the fans that think because I opted out, I have to leave or something like that. No, this is very much in the Nets' hands. Yeah. You feel me? It's a situation where, and I think my full max 5196 or something like that. And nobody's sitting here saying I'm gonna get 5196. So before anybody tries to kill me, nobody's saying that. Yeah. But the Nets have the ability to do something that other people can't. Yeah. If the Nets come to the table like that and they're being aggressive and they're saying, hey, we got 5125 for you, I would say there's a high likelihood that I go back to the Nets. You know what I mean? But if they don't come to the table and they're like, oh, we're gonna give you a 3 for $60. Well, anybody can do that. You know what I mean? So that's when you then take all the other factors into play. I love being in New York with the Nets. I have an established kind of vibe there. I love my teammates. Obviously, like I said, I don't know Harden that well, but KD, Kyrie, DJ, Joe, Jeff Green, all those guys. I love all of them. So, I have an established kind of culture there, all other stuff. I'm friends with the guys. It's very familiar. You know what I mean? But if you're coming with 3 for $60, well, everybody's coming with 3 for $60. Yeah. Right now you come with 5125, you know what I'm saying? So that's where people, and I know as free agency goes on, it'll probably try to be flipped on me and I'll become the villain again and I want to leave and I don't have any loyalty or something like that. But if there's anything that comes out of this article, I need people to understand this is very much still in the Nets' control. They have full bird rights. They can do whatever it is they want. If they come with 3 for $60 and everybody on the planet is going to come with that, then we make a decision, all things being equal, right? But the Nets have the capability. And like you said, this is some owners are they're very asset rich, but they're not liquid rich, right? So you can't pay the tax in the same way other owners can. This is not me pocket watching. It's just a fact. Steve Ballmer and Joe Tsai are very, very liquid rich owners, right? They're way up here. And then all the other owners are somewhere jostling around or whatever. And obviously still being there, still wealthy, still big time people that I can learn from. But those two have obviously separated themselves and can do whatever they want with the luxury tax. So, it's, we're just going to find out and I'll be tuned into my own free agency. In a lot of ways, I just kind of wait, but I do know where market value stands, what the Nets can do. You know what I'm saying? And a lot of teams are probably going to come in at 360 range. That's going to be, what a lot of people do.
And let me be clear for the listeners, because I could say this as the objective observer here. This is very much in the Nets' hands. This is all about, they've got Spencer's bird rights. If they want to resign you for whatever amount they want to, up to the max they can. They can go way beyond what anybody else out there is going to be able to do because, as you mentioned, the fifth year, there's also higher raises for bird rights guys than there are for for the other team. So, it's very much in their hands. And, if you're in a position the Nets are in, you've got three superstars, but they're all in their 30s. You just went through a really injury-riddled season. You've just seen, the fragility of these things. You've got championship caliber roster, but, a couple bad breaks here and there, hopefully not literal breaks, and that's it. But That's why you want a Spencer Dinwiddie in reserve or in, as part of that rotation, right? So, like, to me, easy for me to say, it's not my billions or millions or my luxury tax bill, but to me, that's the logical route for the Nets. You bring you back, you do whatever you can, you try to get Blake back because you're going to need the depth.
Yeah, and on top of that, I think, like, the other thing too, because people have obviously talked about now both my knees to the topic of conversation, but if you look at my career, like, I've had a very healthy career. You know, I had played 80 out of 82 games one season. I played like 70 out of our 86 games another season. Like, you know, and that was because I had the thumb injury, but it had nothing to do with my lower extremities. Then last year, pre-bubble, pre-COVID, I played all 65 of the games. Like, so in general, like, the marker of health for my career has been there, right? So, you know, you pay a healthy man. You come to the table 5-125, 5-130, whatever it is. And I know the fans, it's going to sound crazy, but you go off average annual value, which is in that $25 million starting range. You have the raises, so I don't know what it ends up being on the back end. I just say 125 to round it out. Yeah. And you got the bird rights, you got the luxury tax, whatever. You do the 5 years, and then it's probably done. You know what I mean? Like, that's as transparent as I could possibly be. I mean, you go market value with the bird right raises, the fifth year, all that stuff. You know, and we're probably good. So, you know, the Nets can come to the table and say, hey, we're going to give you everything you want. Or they can say, hey, we value you with everybody else, 3 for $60, something like that. And I can say, okay, well, now this is where, you know, championship, role, location, you know what I'm saying? All that stuff comes into play after that. But if they really come with it and say, hey, we're going for this championship, we are all in. Well, I've always been all in. And I mean, I think I've shown that even with the first contract that I took, the 3 for $35, and trying to build a championship contender with the Nets then.
No doubt. So now we've successfully not only mapped out for everybody what your free agency could look like, but we've given everybody a great CBA crash course here too. So now they understand how bird rights work and the books. Like, so, you know, you're welcome, listeners. You've got a full education today. Speaking of education, actually, I want to get to Galaxy, your new endeavor, in a second here. Real quick, I had seen a note about the possibility of you playing for Nigeria in the Olympics, but I haven't seen anything recently, so I assume that that's probably off the table, and I'm also guessing that your rehab and free agency might have played some factor, but can you clear up anything on that?
Yeah, so I'm committed to play for the Nigerian national team. I won't be in, this Olympics, but the next World Championships and Olympics – I should be in, pretty much, just with the injury and also obviously free agency. It's not something that's, you know, smart, just in case. But for example, if I had signed already or whatever, I'd have played in the Olympics this coming year. Just everything happening at the same time, you just gotta, you know, be a little cautious.
Yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense. It's kind of what I would expect. So you've been busy off the court as well, and I believe it's in beta right now, your new endeavor, Galaxy. So that's like Galaxy with a C, folks. Yeah. Go look it up. When does it officially launch? And more importantly, could you please explain it? I read it. I think I understand it. It sounds like Cameo, but with tokens. And I get very confused after that.
Yeah. So yes, Galaxy is the creator's Galaxy. So it's like Galaxy with a C, as you mentioned. We should be able to be in the App Store in the next 2 to 3 weeks or so. I'll double check with my co-founder, but I'm pretty sure it's 2 to 3 weeks. Other than that, I mean, the simplest way to kind of do it is to think of it as a comprehensive toolkit. So you look at Cameo, you look at OnlyFans outside of explicit content, because we don't support XXX content. You know, Patreons and things of that nature that have these fan clubs and the ability to interact and gain experiential rewards is what we're kind of going after. With that being said, it's designed to look and feel very much like a Twitter, Instagram type of vibe, because you want people to be familiar with it. But we have this toolkit so people can monetize themselves, basically. Because right now, if you look at NFTs and everything that's kind of going on, it's very bespoke. People have a Cameo, they'll have an OnlyFans, they'll have obviously their Instagram, and they'll have, you know, another side website making NFTs on Ethereum. And then they'll try to do maybe a Linktree, you know, link in their Instagram bio, so you can pull up and then see like the 7 different websites that they're trying to get you to and use and all this other stuff. And so it's very friction filled. But at the end of the day, all that stuff is really about is personal monetization. People are trying to make money off of what makes them special. So, you know, for some people, it's their writing. For some people, it's their art. For some people, it's their podcast, their ability to speak, right? You know, in the OnlyFans sense, sometimes it's people's aesthetic, right? Like, it all depends. But people are just trying to find ways to monetize themselves and extract value out of, you know, things that are typically very illiquid, which is talent. You know what I mean? And so Caxie aims to do that more efficiently in one spot. And, you know, obviously we'll evolve over time, but we're built on blockchain to kind of be like the next generation system. So we're trying to offer a lot of current gen toolkit, but also future-proofing it so that we can scale into the future when I believe there will be a Howard token traded for a Spencer token, traded for an Ashley token, et cetera, and so on. So, you know, I think people will start to rethink and relook at value, right? Like think about why gold has value, right? It's because humans say it does. Now, it has a scarcity to it, but humans say it does. Same thing with Bitcoin. If every human on the planet banded together and said Bitcoin has no value, then it wouldn't, right? Like, that's just kind of the way anything in this world works, outside of, I would say, land and water, which are, you know, very basic things that everybody needs. The way we're going to start to think about value in my mind is like I said, extracting that kind of trapped capital. So for us, it's talent, right? And we're looking at like the bank systems change and everything changed and everything. People are moving to more bespoke investments, whether it's art, you know, commodities in terms of gold, or, you know, people are investing in, there's like carbon tokens now where people are trying to invest in reducing carbon emissions and being able to trade their credits, you know what I'm right. saying, to other companies. There's all these different types of investments and people are moving away from kind of the more traditional like bond, like government bonds and things of that nature. So, you know, in terms of future proofing, I'm sorry, I kind of going off on a tangent because I gave you the very basic Calyx explanation, but going off into the future, like, I think we're going to see a world, like I said, where, you know, Ashley's advice time and Howard's writing time and Spencer's, you know, basketball training time are all, you know, traded for each other. And people are going to pay me a dollar to follow them on Twitter. And, you know, it's going to fluctuate like a stock. Like, I'm playing well, like, you know, it's going to go up. I'm playing poorly, like, it might go down a little bit. And, you know, and I'll have a certain circulating supply and all sort of stuff. But like I said, that's off into the future. Right now, what we're trying to do is offer this more kind of like a familiar toolkit so people can make some money.
I still have a hard time getting my head around whether it's NBA Top Shot, any of the NFT stuff, just the idea. And you're right. Like, we assign value to something. As long as we all agree it has value, then it does.
There you go.
So, but it's still hard for me to get my head around a lot of that because some of it feels like people are buying air.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, so when people talk about the NFT craze and stuff like that, and I told everybody, I was like, you know, NFTs, which mean non-fungible tokens, right, they have value because what they do is they create scarcity in something, right? So scarcity creates value, obviously. Like, we all agree it has value, and then there's only one of one, the value goes up. The problem being, right, like you said, people were starting to just like NFT my drink, right? Like, oh, I got this drink at Whole Foods and now I'll make an NFT and then I'm gonna say it's $10,000 and people are like, all right, fuck it, I'll buy it, right? That's where it becomes like selling air, because you have to have kind of a consensus marketplace where things are pegged against one another. It has to be like trading pairs in a sense, yeah, right? Because if not, like, okay, I sold this for $10,000, but then if nobody's willing to buy it, then there's no market for it, right? So what you do by creating something like Caxie is, and you walk people through this kind of stage, well, you start to organically create a market. Because people are now in here making money. They now start to understand the concept of having personal tokens. And then a personal token is weighed against another personal token. And so now you start to get this kind of like trading, you know what I'm saying? Or this system that has a marketplace and fluidity to it. And that's when you can start to like go into the future with the NFTs and other things that allow for that. So I think Top Shot is great because like baseball cards, just digital. But I think a lot of what people were starting to do was just slap NFT on it and I'm going to sell it and let's hope it makes money. And then if it gets stuck in my purchaser's hand with no secondary market, well, fuck them, because I just made 10 grand. So, oh, well. And then they're having buyer's remorse. And now you're screwing the market because now they're like, I bought this for $10,000. I thought I was going to double. Now it's worth nothing. I'm never going to trust in blockchain again because this is all BS and it's all bad. But really all non-fungible token means is that I'm putting a serial number on something and telling you that there's only one of one. Yes. But if there's only one of a trash can, it's still a trash can. You know what I mean? Like, it's still a trash can. Like, oh, well. But, you know, when we started to get into like baseball cards and things like that, or a car, for example, like my dream car is called a Koenigsegg Jamera. There's only going to be 300 made, right? Dream car. I hope to get it. I should get it. But that's another story. But there's only 300 made. That scarcity is part of what makes the value go up. Sure. But it also has its value. It's a car, just like a baseball card is, you know what I'm saying? It's a card and there's a market for it. Like, people understand Pokemon cards and baseball cards and basketball cards. So Top Shot has its place. But like I said, somebody making an NFT out of their drink, like, you know, as people just doing.
That's my fear with Top Shot, actually, not to get on too big of a tangent here, but that so many people were jumping in for speculative purposes because they liked the idea of it, wanted to be part of it, and liked the idea of just the constant increase in value of everything that they owned and just trying to flip it, that as if people lose interest or they lose faith in it, the bottom could just fall out. Because as soon as everybody, like, people got offended when I referred to it as a pyramid scheme, but there's a little bit of that to it. You need people to keep buying in and to believe in it for the value to keep increasing. And so like, it's that, I don't know. I'm still, like I say, I'm still having a hard time getting my head around it a little bit. All right. But let me ask you about Calyxy just more specifically before we go. Somebody downloads the app. It's in the app store in the next couple of weeks. Somebody downloads it and they're big Spencer Dinwiddie fans. And so they want their Calyxy experience to be based around you. What do they get on day one when they sign in? What does it look like? What does it feel like? Where does the tokenization come into it? What are they getting for it?
Yeah. So again, day one, you're going to be able to download an app. It's going to feel very, I would say, Twitter, right? It's going to look kind of sort of like a purple Twitter.
It's a social media interface kind of thing.
Yeah. It's going to be very social media interface, very web two. You're not going to feel that type of like insane friction. The offerings that I will have for fans will be what I allow, right? So we have some custom tools and we also have some stock tools. So stock tools are like, you can buy a follow on Instagram or Twitter. You can buy like FaceTime, you know what I'm saying? Time. So like, let's say I want to do a 10-minute FaceTime or something like that. You can buy that. Sure. That's a stock one. We also have birthday messages, like a Cameo, right? So that's a very stock one. And we also have like custom requests, right? Custom requests where they can put in a bid or where I can put in a bid. So I can say, look, for one of my custom slots, I want it to be basketball training time, right? And so if you buy, you know what I'm saying, this, then I'll give you 30 minutes of basketball training time, right? Then they also will be able to put in their own custom request, which is them saying like, hey, I want you to show up to my birthday party or something, right? And they say, I'll pay you $10,000 to show up to my birthday party, and I can either accept it or decline it. You know what I mean? So it's all of those kind of interaction based things. And the tokenization is basically, like I said, remember that word I know inspires fear. This will not feel as if you're tokenizing anything to start. The reason why we have some of that base layer grammar in there and language in there and all that other stuff is so as we go into the future, it won't be like we're completely changing the system.
I see.
You know what I mean, like, he will be familiar with it, but the tokens at onset are pegged to a dollar. So like, really, like, you're going to pay 5,000 Spencer tokens to, you know, work out with me, but really you're just paying $5,000. You know what I mean? So your credit card is going to get charged $5,000. It's going to show up as 5,000 Spencer tokens being transacted in, but that's how it's going to look and feel. And then, like I said, as we go into the future, when NFTs come into play and the marketplace and things come into play, that's when like token modeling starts to look more live, right? So we start to look more like stocks and things like that. But we're still probably, I would say, at least 6 months to a year from that. So that's not something that day one, you're going to be like, oh no, I'm overwhelmed. No, it's going to look like a purple Twitter, where you can pay Spencer, you know, $10 for him to follow you on Twitter, or you can pay him 10 grand to show up to your birthday party. And, you know, it'll be 10 Spencer tokens or 10,000 Spencer tokens, but it's a dollar.
That makes sense. Yeah, no, there's an app and a website called Stage It where musicians can directly perform. And a lot of them did it during the pandemic when everybody's stuck at home, they can't play live shows. And I did exactly that. I paid for 50 whatever tokens for the Stage It app. And then I have to spend a certain amount to see that artist. And then you can tip them using those same tokens too. So yeah, you've just bought credit basically.
Exactly.
And then you use it. So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Who else is going to be part of this? Like they download Galaxy in a few weeks. It's not just you. There's others on this. So like who else will they have access to?
Oh shit. We have like over 110 creators at the moment. I mean, the biggest.
Some of the highlights. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'd say the biggest probably Ezekiel Elliott, Iman Shumpert, Tiana Taylor, myself. So Matt James, The Bachelor. All right. Yeah. We'll stop there. But yeah, I mean, sorry, my co-founder is actually behind me. Shout out, Solo. But yeah, some things I can and can't speak on. Like, I know there's another African artist that, you know, has, I think, like 20 million combined following, but like, I know I can't speak on him, so I didn't mention his name. But some people are like about to sign, some people have signed, but like I said, it's about 110 creators, I think, right now that we have locked and loaded, ready to go. And then, you know, from various walks, right? Like I said, The Bachelor, we got a football player, we got some basketball players, obviously, because of my network. We have some Instagram models, some fitness trainers, like just people.
Very cool. No, this sounds fascinating. I can't wait to actually see it live and get a sense for it. It does feel like the next like natural iteration of what we've seen, right? Going from social media to all these other platforms that have allowed more interaction, different kinds of interaction, the Cameo aspect of it. It seems like you're incorporating a lot of, like, this feels like the next logical step in that evolution.
So. Definitely. We feel the same way. I mean, like you said, Cameo just tried to raise it, I believe, $1 billion valuation to continue to build out their kind of toolkit and their robustness. And we see OnlyFans trying to raise it $1 billion valuation to move away from explicit content. So, you know, they're kind of trying to build what we have built, but obviously they have following that, you know, we aim to have. Like, we don't obviously have as many followers as OnlyFans and stuff like that. But so it's going to be an inflection point. Like, hopefully, obviously, before OnlyFans can pivot away from explicit content, we can hit the ground running and we just port everybody over. And there's your multi-billion dollar valuation and keep it rocking and rolling.
There you go. Also, as I, as somebody who is obviously a large consumer of media, being in media, I can tell you, like, once you get a reputation, OnlyFans, like, you're gonna take a while for people to look at you a little differently, like you're cleaned up, so that, you know, you'll have a good head start. Before I let you go, this is not publishing for a few days, so I think there might be two games in the books by the time we get there. Do you have a finals prediction, and would it depend on whether or not Giannis is playing?
I think it definitely depends on whether Giannis is playing. I would say no Giannis. Wait, who has home court? Milwaukee has home court?
No, Phoenix does.
Phoenix has home court.
Yeah.
Okay. I should have known that because they want me to go to game two, which is like, oh, I'm tripping. This is tough.
It's actually a tough matchup, like, yeah, especially because two teams we didn't necessarily expect to see here, and Giannis is hurt. So,
at all. I mean, I would say, and it's also hard because I have a friend in campaign, also a friend in Chris Middleton. So it's like, you know, I didn't want to say, yo, I'm going for Chris, and then Cam be like, yo, bro, what you thinking? You know, so I am closer to Chris than Cam, though. So, I mean, I'm a go Bucks just off the strength of that if Giannis is healthy. I think if Giannis isn't healthy, then it's tough, though, because I feel like Drew is the type of defender to give Bucks some issues. And I don't know how they're going to match up. So they might put Drew on Chris Paul, but I would much rather have the bigger defender in Chris Middleton on Chris Paul. Just because, like, Chris Paul's trying to get to the mid range, shoot his shot. It's much more kind of like a death taxes thing. Like, he's going to do it. You just have to try to hinder it. And some days he's not as efficient with it as others. And so you live with it. Whereas, like, Book, I feel like if you can really, make his life miserable, which I think Drew has the capability of doing. Not saying he won't score, but if he's inefficient, then, like, I don't think the Suns really have the same type of chance. And then obviously if Giannis is healthy, he can get very easy shots at the rim. You know what I mean? So that's why I would go Bucks, obviously, if Giannis is healthy. If he's not, you know, shoot, like, Suns gonna hit threes, like, where are their easy buckets gonna come from? I think the Brook Aiden matchup will be one to watch. Aiden being a little bit younger, a little more live body. Brooke being obviously strong, and people don't know, but Brooke is a phenomenal player. Like before KD and Kyrie and all them, like Brooke might have been the best player I've played with in the NBA. Like he's big time, you know what I'm saying? And you know, he's a very goofy dude, has his, you know what I'm saying, interests in Disney and whatnot, but like extremely talented. So it'll be interesting to see if he asserts himself, if Giannis is out. Just a lot of variables. And we didn't expect him, so we didn't really analyze this to your point. So I'm a roll with Bucks, but it's a roll of the dice to me.
Yeah, which is a good thing. We need a finals that's kind of a roll of the dice. It's like, yeah. It's interesting. It's great having like different teams, different faces than we've seen in years, and a series that none of us can really peg that easily. So that, I think that's all good.
No, I agree with you.
Cool. Spencer, this has been great, man. Kept you a little long. I appreciate you spending the time. Thank you for explaining crypto and Galaxy to me. I still got to hit the books. I got a lot more learning to do, but it's fascinating. I wish you the best with that and with the rest of your, I guess not rehab, just the return and yeah. And free agency. Can't wait to see where it all lands. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate you.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Spencer Dinwiddie and a shout out to Ashley Blackwood for helping connect us. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston, and thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter, and then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter @HowardBeck.